On today's Money with Friends, some of the country's biggest poultry companies, including Tyson, Perdue, and Pilgrim's Pride, are accused of orchestrating a massive price fixing scheme involving broiler chickens. We're talking lessons from the chicken pricing scandal. Plus, if you're worried about a recession, we've got three ways investors can decrease their stock market risk. Those two headlines, plus the big idea, tying them all together on today's Money with Friends. Welcome to Money with Friends. I am certified financial planner Bobby Rebel from the Financial Grown Up Podcast, coming to you from my very grown up kitchen in New York City.
And from my mom's half finished basement in Detroit, Michigan, where we make the Stacky Benjamin Show, I'm Joe Saul-Sehy.
This is a show where we take the big headlines, we talk about them with our friends, and we learn what we can do to make our lives a little bit richer. We top it all off with a big idea to set us all up for success. And by the way, we tape this live so you can hear all of my bumbles. Not the smoothest opening there, Joe.
And if you're bumbling with your budget, how about that for a transition?
Yep.
You want to use Tiller, your financial life in a spreadsheet automatically updated every day. Tiller's the only tool that automatically updates Google Sheets or Excel. You choose with your daily transactions and balances. Head to stackybenjamins.com/tiller. That's T-I-L-L-E-R. stackybenjamins.com/tiller for more. We'll talk about them a little bit later. But right now, Bobby, we're going to talk about chicken, apparently.
We are going to talk about chicken, which is interesting because there's been so much focus in the market about companies getting into the vegetable chicken, the fake burger business. What do you call it?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Beyond Burger, Impossible Burger.
Burger, Impossible, all these crazy names. And a lot of the chicken companies have been diversifying and buying stakes in these or creating these. But now we're kind of refocusing onto chicken.
Yes. Are you chicken to talk about chicken? Are you too chicken to talk about chicken?
We're going to talk about chicken. Let's get one of our friends to bring us into the first headline.
Good morning. You supply the coffee. We'll bring the headlines. Here they come.
All right, here we go. This is a story that I found in the New York Post, but actually when I looked closer, just to give fair credit, it is a Reuters story. And it just says by Reuters, it does not say the author. So apologies if the author should be credited. Shares of Tyson, other poultry producers fall over price-fixing probe. The U.S. Department of Justice has begun a criminal probe into allegations that Tyson Foods and other poultry processors, including Pilgrim's Pride and Sanderson Farms, colluded to fix poultry prices, court documents show. The DOJ filed a motion to intervene and stay discovery of evidence in an antitrust lawsuit involving the companies and has convened a grand jury to investigate. U.S. food distributors have filed lawsuits against Tyson and other poultry processors, alleging that the companies have colluded since 2008 to reduce output and manipulate prices. Quote from Sanderson Farms, quote, the civil plaintiff's claims as to Sanderson Farms are wholly without merit, and we are committed to defending the case vigorously, adding, this is Sanderson Farms, adding it has not been subpoenaed in connection with the DOJ investigation. Pilgrim's Pride, which is mostly owned by Brazilian meat packer JBS SA, said it did not fix prices. Quote, Pilgrim strongly denies any allegations of anti-competitive conduct. The company welcomes the opportunity to defend itself against these claims through the legal process. Tyson, which has previously denied the allegations, did not immediately respond to requests, but they have previously denied. And I want to just mention a couple other things to round up the story that I pulled from other sources. This is from Eater, and I think this is really interesting. It talks about them driving up the price of broiler chickens. These are allegations. I just want to remind everyone, allegations. Driving up the price of broiler chickens by destroying flocks of breeder hens, thereby reducing production rates. And the Eater piece also says in parentheses here, this scheme is oddly reminiscent of the plot of a recent Billions episode called Chicken Town. I'm going to have to check that out. Have you seen that, Joe?
I have not. We don't have, I think it's on Showtime, HBO.
Showtime, yeah.
Yeah, I don't have either one of those, so.
The suit, this is where it gets interesting. The suit alleges that these companies used a subscription service called AgriStats to share information with each other about the age of their chickens and operating costs. And they point out that trading of this kind of information would be extraordinarily beyond what any rational business would do. Now, according to the New York Times, the price of a broiler chicken jumped by 50% between 2008 and 2016, despite the fact, Joe, despite the fact that the cost of feeding the chickens went down during this period. And three companies control nearly half of the American chicken market. Those three companies that control nearly half of the American chicken market are Sanderson, Tyson, and Pilgrim's Pride. So, and the New York Times, just to bring in one more thing, the chicken company shared unusually detailed information with AgriStats, everything from the age of breeder flocks to monthly operating profits. The data was technically anonymous, but the specificity of the numbers allowed, again, this is from the New York Times, allowed industry leaders to deduce how many birds their competitors were hatching and reduce their own production rates accordingly. So, whoa. That's a lot.
Just to give people a little thought on kind of the back of the envelope math that would have to happen here for this to be true. So if they weren't colluding, if these companies weren't, here's the way it would have to work. If you're destroying, if you're killing part of your flock so that you have fewer, you have to do the math to know that every single one that remains is going to be worth enough to make up for the lack of chickens that you have. So because of that, if they, and because you, it's so difficult to control that type of a market. I don't know that any company would be confident enough to do that, which is why I like your quote here that says, you know, it's beyond rational thought that we would do that. Rationally, you can't do that because these other two companies that also control a big part of the production of chickens are just going to eat your lunch. So if they were colluding, you could see them doing it. If they weren't colluding, it's the dumbest thing ever.
Yeah, I mean, it would be very risky to do that to your business if you did not have the information that allegedly they may have had, because otherwise you could really be in a ton of trouble because you basically would be sacrificing, I hate to say it that way, but sacrificing so much profit when you do this kind of thing. Not to mention it, it's just like sick.
You also see the number of people involved in those industries. Chickens were big business where I used to live in Northeast Texas, Southwest Arkansas. I mean, whenever we ventured into Arkansas, that is Tyson country. And so we saw chicken trucks all the time. And so many people rely on that. And just think about the number of people that would have had to be in on that, right? I mean, you could keep a little bit of a secret, but if you're destroying a ton of chicken at one time, I mean, it's not just Bob who knows about that. No. It's going to be, what, 50 people are going to know about it, you know? So keeping that type of a secret also is...
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, it doesn't mean it's not happening. We don't know. I mean, we don't have any idea that it's happening. You know, I didn't find... Let's talk about what we can do with this piece. I didn't... When it comes to chicken price fixing, I couldn't think of anything that we can do. But I did think that while this is illegal and fixing a price on anything, whether you've got a, I don't know, lemonade stand or whatever it might be, fixing those prices is difficult. Budget fixing is not. And how fun would this be to apply this, Bobby, in a different way? I take my budget, you take your budget, and we agree together that we're only going to spend X amount of money. We're going to cap our spending. And we have this friendly challenge. Instead of two companies that are fighting to keep the price of chicken up, we're fighting together to keep our grocery budget down. So we have this. I know whenever anybody I know has done something like that, a grocery challenge, a biggest loser weight challenge, a how many books have you read challenge, like those things not only make you a better person, they're also a ton of fun to do. So, you know, maybe it's a stretch to talk about go from chicken price fixing into budget fixing, but that would be useful.
No, I think that you make a good point about accountability. And I think that is something that can help all of us in so many aspects of our life. Certainly, you mentioned with nutrition and eating, it's good to be accountable to somebody, but also with your money. I think that's a really great point. If you can get other people on your team and basically, you know, if you're comfortable enough to share data, allegedly these companies were sharing data. Again, we don't know. But, you know, sharing data and sharing information, I think, can be really powerful in being successful financially if you're comfortable and within the appropriate boundaries of that. And so I think that's an interesting analogy as well.
No, and that's a good point, is that for these three companies to form, like, let's say a mastermind together is illegal for a lot of reasons, because a lot of people's, you know, grocery budget depends on them being able to afford the stuff. But you and I having a mastermind together to talk about best practices about what we do, that's not only not illegal, that's awesome.
Right. Sharing information can be very powerful. I mean, one thing that I think has become more common, especially with millennials, is sharing information about salaries. And a lot of salary transparency has done a lot of good for our society in recent years in terms of bringing up equality, in terms of what people make, making sure people are paid appropriately for the job that they're doing, regardless of their race, ethnicity, gender, et cetera. I think that sharing information about that has helped us all come a long way. So sharing data in and of itself can be a very good thing and a force for good. Sometimes it can be a force for evil.
So it maybe is a little bit of a stretch, but I think that's a good takeaway, sharing information.
I think it's always good to stretch if it's for good.
Yeah. Our next deadline. I'm sorry.
Was that your takeaway?
That was my takeaway.
Oh, okay. Can I say my takeaway?
Yeah. No, you can't say. Of course.
Never mind.
I thought we had your takeaway. Tell us your takeaway.
Yeah, okay. My takeaway was that data can be used for evil, but I didn't say it explicitly. So I wanted to say my takeaway in like a complete sentence, Joe.
Got use your data for good.
Use your data for good.
Absolutely. Our next deadline comes to us from Fortune. This is written by Ben Carlson. Worried about recession? Here are three ways investors can decrease stock market risk. I brought this one to the table, and I Bobby did a serious eye roll, because whenever I read these, well, we'll read the piece first, and then we'll talk about this piece.
I think there are some good lessons here.
I think there are too, but yeah. Well, here's what Ben writes. How much can you handle? Determining how you invest should always begin with an assessment of your risk profile. That's typically a combination of your time horizon, will and willingness, ability, and need to take risk in your portfolio. By the way, Joe's commentary, that's garbage. That's not where you start, but we'll get back to that. Ability and need require some planning around your goals, current financial circumstances, age, income, family situation, and such, but these are reasonably easy to figure out. The hardest part in this equation is determining your willingness to take risk, because risk perception is constantly changing with the markets. When markets are doing well, you feel like you've taken on more risk, and when markets are doing poorly, you feel like you should have taken on less risk. And the main deterrent of these feelings in almost any investment portfolio will be the stock market, since stocks can swing wildly from optimism to pessimism, from booms to bust, and from high levels to low levels. Therefore, how much money you're willing to allocate to stocks will have an outsized impact on the volatility of your portfolio. And then he goes over a few things. Number one, he says, don't get overly complex. Do you just want to peel these off instead of reading the whole thing, yeah, Bobby? We're going to peel these off one by one.
Yeah.
So his first thing here, don't get overly complex. What do you think about that?
I think that, you know, you can't oversimplify also, I guess. And I don't mean to be derogatory to it, but you also have to, be thoughtful about where you put your money. And, but I guess what he's saying is basically, don't get into complex investment instruments, especially if you don't know what you're doing, because they can be very risky.
Yeah, he's talking hedging strategies, option strategies.
You need to know what you're doing.
Yeah, and I'll see people get into obscure asset classes. Like, instead of peeling off just maybe a little piece of your portfolio and gold or precious metals or natural resources, they'll get esoteric and say, well, nickel looks good right now. Oh, come on. Unless you're somebody that really knows some of these specific, palladium is where I want to be with my money. And unless you know specifically those markets and know what that's going to do to your portfolio, keeping it simple is easy. I mean, you'll see a lot of people, especially we see it in the FIRE movement, a lot of people parrot what J.L. Collins says, which is have one fund, the total U.S. stock market, and that's it. Now, I think for a variety of reasons, that's going to explode. Not that J.L. Collins is wrong, but most people...
Well,
Most people aren't used to that amount of risk. And when the market comes tumbling down, I would say 40% of the people that do that strategy are going to blow themselves up. They're going to completely freak out when it goes down 40% and they're going to lose. JL Collins isn't wrong. Over a long period of time, that's not a bad strategy, but you got to be willing to stay on.
But that goes back to the very first thing said in this piece, which is risk tolerance and really coming to terms with and being honest with yourself about your risk tolerance, which I think is a very hard thing for most people. I think most people don't really get it until the, you know, SHIT hits the fan. Then they really understand the meaning of risk tolerance. And it also brings us into what the next point that the author says in this, the next strategy, which is something that I actually think people need to talk more about.
This is the biggest one and the one that I like too. Own uncorrelated assets. One of the worst parts about investing in emerging markets is the fact that they have bone-crushing volatility. Since 1988, emerging markets and U.S. stocks have similar returns but drastically different volatility. And it goes over emerging markets volatility versus the S&P 500 volatility. Even though the returns are very close to the same from 88 to 2018, as of the time this piece was written, the emerging markets index had averaged 10.4%, while the S&P 500 had averaged 10.2. However, with volatility, when we look at the swings, the standard deviation in these, volatility is 17%, meaning that most of the time the S&P 500 will go from 27 to negative 7. That's the back and forth, where the emerging markets index had swings of 33%. So 44% all the way down to negative 24%. Some wild swings for the same exact results.
I think people make the mistake of thinking that they are diversified when in fact they've got investments in different instruments that are correlated. And I don't know that that point is often understood. I mean, it's, for example, when you have a backup facility in, let's say, a manufacturing plant, because you want to protect yourself if something bad happens, you have to make sure they're not on the same power grid. You have to make sure they're not next to each other. Yeah. You know, so it doesn't really provide real protection if they're not going to be subject to different factors to make them move in different directions.
You know, what's interesting here to me is that when we used to look at, so we had these Morningstar things that we worked with, these software programs where we could take different asset classes and put them together and see how they reacted. And it was pretty incredible. You would often, Bobby, take an asset class that was more risky than the rest of the portfolio, add it to a portfolio, and it would decrease the overall risk of the person's entire, even though that was a riskier position, because it was such a different risk than you were taking with everything else. The volatility along the path was different because you had things going up and down at different points. It was really neat to see, because people go, boy, I wouldn't do that. That would be really risky. Well, look at what happens when you put this in your portfolio. It actually tunes it down, which is why, by the way, a lot of investors have a problem with this. We all want every position in our portfolio to be up at once. We want them all to go up. And when one's done poorly for 3 or 4 years, instead of putting money into that asset class to keep your balance the same, what do we usually do as people? We go, well, that's stunk for the last 4 years. I'm going to take money out of it. And when we do that, we blow up our strategy.
I agree with that. But then there's also the thinking that why would you sell the winner? I mean, it kind of goes both ways.
Yeah.
And I've also been advised, you know, be careful about, you know, when you're going to sell something, let's say for whatever reason, and we're going to get to life stages in a minute, you do need to extract some, you know, there are times when you want to sell a stock and it's a valid thing to do, or an investment, whatever it may be, to fund something in your life. And you have to choose what to sell. And, you know, at the end of the day, sometimes an investment just isn't a good investment because fundamentally it's not a good investment. So I don't think what you're saying is hang on to the losers that are losers. Hang on to something that's there for a purposeful reason to diversify and balance your portfolio. And it's a skill to figure out the difference.
Yeah, we have to delineate between individual stocks here, individual positions, and asset classes. Individual positions that are winning are winning for a reason. And and selling off a winner, I made that mistake with a client. I remember we sold Apple stock after it went up for 2 years in a row, way, way, way back, right? Like 2000X. And I still look at that. I haven't been a financial planner in 10 years. We sold this stock 5 years before I left as a financial advisor, specifically sold it because I remember us having this conversation about what more can they do? How much better can this get? And it got a ton better, and they would have made a ton more money. Yeah. But with asset classes, so an asset class is just all large company stocks in that class. There's this very real thing, which is reversion to the mean. If you have a whole class like the S&P 500 that's been on a run for a while, it's what everybody's worried about right now. It's been on a run. When's it going to come down? If you own that in an index or a mutual fund, selling out of that to keep your allocation in that the same before it reverts back down to the mean, and going into your underrepresented classes that need to be added to that will also revert to the mean, which means they'll come back, I think is a fantastic strategy.
I like that.
Before we get to the third piece, I want to go back to the beginning when I said this is because it's going to tie in with what we talk about next, Bobby. At the beginning of this piece, Ben wrote, you should always begin with an assessment of your risk profile. And so people have a retirement plan at work. And what's the first thing they look at? The person from the company has them look at this risk profile calculator. How much risk are you comfortable with? I think that's garbage. Here's what I think. Who cares initially how much risk you can take until you know how much risk you need to take? And then the real question is, can you train yourself to take the amount of risk that you need to take? Can you get educated enough to be able to take that risk? So let's say, I mean, every retirement comes down to this easy equation. You need to save X amount of dollars times Y return to get the goal. So X and Y equals the goal. If we save less money, we obviously need a higher return then to get that thing. But we need to know what those two things are. And once we know that the return we need to reach our goal is 8%, then what do? Then we look at assets that do 8%. And that is when we do the risk calculation. And we go, can I stomach those? Is this agreeable to my way of life? Am I okay with that level of risk? We don't do the risk profile first. I think we have to do what we need first.
Yeah, I agree. There are calculators and there are ways to approach it where you see the final numbers. You say, okay, this is how much you want to have each year in, let's say, retirement, and or this is what you want, you know, sort of in your account on the day that you shift into however you define retirement. And retirement definition is changing these days. And then if you say, okay, if you don't up your risk profile and take this amount of risk, you will not get to that number. When people see it that way, they're often much more willing to take on the risk. And remember, it's in those kinds of things, it's spread out over so many years. And so many of us, and it's a good thing, just don't look at our 401ks or retirement accounts that often. And that's okay. As long as they're diversified in asset classes, as you point out, I think that it's kind of sometimes better to not be looking at it if you got a 40-year horizon.
Yeah, there's a lot of people out there very safely achieving nothing, if you know what I mean. The last piece, though, is on that note, which is because I think it's all about your time horizon and what return you need based on that. Ben writes, expand your time horizon. He says, if you'd bought the S&P 500 the Friday before Lehman Brothers went bankrupt back in September of 2008, you would be up more than 190% on your money. It's not bad considering we were entering the eye of the storm for the financial crisis, but you would have had to live through a 45% loss over the ensuing 6 months to earn those returns. Extending your time horizon is one of the best edges an investor can get these days. And then he goes over, if you look at the U.S. stock market on a daily basis, it's positive 54% of the time, negative 46. On a monthly average, though, it goes up to 63.37. During a year, I quote this number a lot. I say the stock market goes up about 70% of the time. The real number right now, it, by the way, is 73%, goes down 27% of the time in a year. Over 20 years, historically, from 1926 to 2018, the stock market has gone up 100% of those time periods, meaning your chance of losing money historically was zero. Over 10, that's over 20 years. There's no 20-year time period in the S&P 500 that you lost money.
I like knowing that. I think that will give people a lot of peace of mind. I also, and this, well, it's a stretch, but it's not. An analogy that I like to make to this is when you go to look for a flight now, you can go on a number of services. I used just the Google flights, and you can see if you click in flexible dates. So you change the date, you're willing to change the date in and the date out, and you can kind of see how prices shift on those dates. So you might have had an idea that you were going to sell you know, right out the date that happened to be after the Lehman Brothers crisis that you were just talking about. But maybe if that's happening and it's down, maybe you don't sell because you see the whole flexible date calendar and you hold on if you have that flexibility. And that can be a very powerful tool as an investor. If you have a drop in the market and you maybe you were going to sell just for personal reasons or whatever, but you don't have to, and you can just wait and not take those losses, that time flexibility on your investment horizon can be a huge asset.
You and I talked about this a little bit ahead of time, though, and I like your other point on this, which is that, you know, time's a finite thing. And yes. And so this one isn't as elastic as I've seen people wait too long, Bobby, and you have too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you have to day one. I mean, we both have young adult children, and I think we've both talked to them about making sure that on day one of your first real job, you need to be signing up for the retirement plans because time works so much better than you do. I mean, just having the time for your money to grow is such a gift to yourself. Even, I mean, my guys, they have Roth IRAs, which is amazing. So, you know, summer job money can go in there, especially when that's a time when for many people, they are safely under the caps for Roth IRAs. They can do that. It's literally never too young to give yourself the gift of extra years of compound interest. That's my mom talk.
Well, that's fantastic. And I'm wondering if that's your takeaway or you have a...
That could be my takeaway. Sure.
That's a great takeaway. Yeah. My takeaway is don't start off with your risk tolerance. Start off with what risk you need. And even though I think that makes sense to people, I rarely see people do it that way. They start off with what am I comfortable with? Not what do I need to do? Start with what you need. Yeah. In just a second, Bobby and I are going to have the big idea, which is how are we going to combine collusion, allegedly, in the chicken market with three ways that you can lower risk in your portfolio. We're going to get to that in just a second. But first, I want to talk about Tiller, because Tiller is something that my spouse Cheryl and I use to track our expenses. And you know what's cool about Tiller is not only is it spreadsheet based, which means that we can decide if we want it very complex, lots of charts and graphs, tons of little tiny categories, really granular, or we can just track big picture. I track big picture. My mom tracks very, very granular stuff. You can also, though, make the transactions very easy to track, because not only do you have a button that you can press that automatically brings in and adds to your spreadsheet everything, your investments, how much you spent on coffee, on groceries, whatever it might be, everything gets automatically downloaded to your spreadsheet so you don't have to manually enter it. But not only that, there is a very simple program in there which allows you to make sure that some recurring transactions immediately get added. So if you pay the water bill every month, you put in the name of the water company. Whenever that bill comes in, it automatically gets tracked as your water bill. So saves you a ton of time, while at the same time, you've got the flexibility to make it work however you want. Third, and we won't get into the pricing, but go check out the pricing. We're going to give you 2 months free because you used our link. But after that, it's incredibly reasonable to use Tiller. Head to stackingbenjamins.com/Tiller for more, and they'll hook you up with, normally, if you go in the front door, it's 1 month free. But because you know Bobby and I, it's 2 months free. You're welcome, people. You're very, very welcome. All right. We got our big idea. This is where we take these two headlines and we put them together. Do you want to go first or you want me to go first?
You go first.
Oh, the pressure's on me today. I like that better because yours is always better. So
not true.
So my big idea here today, guys, is this. Worry about the right stuff. As we record this, you know, we've had presidential debates going on. We've talked about chicken price fixing in our first headline. I was reading this morning about more people potentially being poisoned in the Dominican Republic. We have all of these things going on, which are horrible, but you can't control them and you can't even influence them. So to some degree, you have to disengage. But you can worry about not taking the right risks in your portfolio, and you can meet with your friends and have a budget fixing competition. Those are things that you can do. And we never do those. You know why? Because we're always embroiled in this stuff that we can't control and we can't influence. Disengage from those. Focus on the things that you control. And not only will you be further ahead, I think it's a lot more fun than complaining about things that... that I see so many miserable people, Bobby, on Facebook. And I'm like, guess what you can do? You can instantly change that. And it's just up to you.
That was really good, Joe.
Thank you. I get the gold star.
I feel like I have so much more knowledge and just such a sense of calm from that. I was very zen, which you're usually not like that. That was almost I feel like that was a mindfulness exercise.
I am very zen. No, I am never zen. But anyway.
All right. Here's my big idea. Not nearly as good. We talk a lot about trusting your gut and doing what feels right. But the truth is data matters as well. It's not just about feelings. It's about the numbers. And that stuff can be used for good or for evil. It can be used to benefit us, but it can also be used against us. In the case of this chicken fixing scandal, my friends, where, by the way, nothing has been proven and the companies are denying it. Data is a central focus. And it could be used to prove their innocence, but it also could be used to prove to find them guilty. When it comes to recession-proofing your portfolio, while you could go with your gut feeling, you are probably better off using data to help guide you to find things that can help you buffer your investments and to clarify your goals, like making sure that you have different positions that are uncorrelated, like thinking about that timeline and being realistic about the risk that you need to take. Data is driving more and more, and the more we learn to watch out for it as a tool for bad and use it as a tool for good, the better we can do to protect ourselves and our money.
I feel like yours is like a superhero one. Use your powers for good, Bobby. Use your powers for good.
I always try to use my powers for good, Joe.
Well, that's awesome. And you know what? You can use your powers for good by reviewing this show. How about that? Please leave us a review. Thanks to everybody who's done that before. That tells people exactly what they're getting into when they listen to Money with Friends. And we'll be back with another one on Tuesday. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Bye, everyone. Go be grownups.
This show is created and hosted by Josal Sihai and Bobby Rebel and is a joint venture of BRK Media LLC and Stacking Benjamins LLC, copyright 2019. Our engineer is Caden Thompson. And for a list of our friends who appear on the podcast, head to our website, moneywithfriendspodcast.com. You can also check out our schedule for upcoming recording sessions so you can join us and be part of the show. As with anything, remember you shouldn't take advice from any of us or any other video or podcast without first talking to your financial advisor, and that the people in this episode are here for your and their entertainment purposes only. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and we'll see you back here next time with a real episode of Money with Friends.